Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 150,000 Americans are treated for vitiligo. That's an autoimmune disease, the cause of which remains a mystery. So far, vitiligo has been incurable, but researchers at Tufts University in Boston recently developed a topical cream. It's been found to reverse the effects of vitiligo. Dr. David Rosmarin is a dermatologist and vice chair for education and research in the Department of Dermatology at Tufts Medical Center. He's the lead author of the study that developed the new cream. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
So could you define vitiligo and what we mean by it?
Sure. Vitiligo is an autoimmune disease where the immune system, which is supposed to fight off infections, is instead attacking the pigment cells in the body, leading to white patches on people's skin.
It's most famously, you know, whenever someone famous gets it, like Michael Jackson, we've heard had it, and that's why he was lightening his skin. But that's not treating vitiligo, that's just adjusting to it.
Yeah, so there's currently no FDA-approved treatments for vitiligo, but there are treatments to depigment the skin, which some people do, such as Michael Jackson. And there are multiple celebrities who suffer from it, such as John Hamm, Steve Martin, Winnie Harlow, and most famously Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm. We said 150,000 people are being treated for it, but millions might have it to one degree or another. Do we know how common it is?
Yeah, we think it's about 1% of the population. So about 3 million people in the United States are estimated to suffer from vitiligo.
I know from personal experience that it's not just a cosmetic issue, because when I get a sunburn on that unprotected skin where there's no melanin, it burns and it doesn't heal very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a cosmetic issue. It's a medical disease.
Right.
And I think we have to be careful also to make sure we respect patients who are very comfortable living with vitiligo as they are, mm-hmm. and also patients who really want to reverse the disease and get their pigment back.
This is I want to ask, why don't we know what causes it? Why is it still a mystery?
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of research into the cause of vitiligo recently, but there is still a bunch unknown. But we do know that there are certain parts of the immune system that are too active that are killing those pigment cells in the body. But it's recently come to light that there's a particular arm of the immune system that's too active that's been a challenge to suppress. And now we have new treatments that are coming out that seem to be good at suppressing this arm of the immune system, and leading us to be hopeful that we can give people options for repigmentation.
There are varying degrees of vitiligo, right? I mean, once you get it, it may not spread, or it may. Some people have it on the face. Other people have it on the arms and legs and back. I mean, it just depends, right?
Yeah, it most commonly affects exposed areas of the skin, such as the face and the hands being amongst the most common areas, but you can get it anywhere. It's also common to get on the genitals as well, which can lead people to feel uncomfortable being intimate with others. But it really can affect anywhere, most commonly face and hands, though.
You're the lead author of the study that developed the topical cream that treats vitiligo that spurred this conversation. Tell us about what the study did and how you came up with the cream.
Yeah. So currently, Incyte manufactures a medicine called ruxolitinib, or Jakafi, which is taken orally by patients who suffer from certain blood disorders, such as polycythemia vera, and it's FDA-approved for that indication. And this class of medicine, which is called a JAK inhibitor, is particularly good at that arm of the immune system that we're finding out is too active in vitiligo, whereas our other medicines that suppress the immune system are not very good at suppressing that particular arm that's overactive in vitiligo. So we decided to try to use this medication topically to avoid the systemic side effects. Mm. We saw very promising results, particularly of the face. Several years ago, we did an initial pilot study that involved about 10 patients, and we saw a dramatic pigmentation, particularly of the face. And that led to Insight sponsoring the largest randomized controlled study ever done, looking at this cream compared to just the vehicle alone. And 157 patients were involved in this study across the country. And it showed very promising results, where about half the patients who were on the cream saw a significant response at the 6 months mark. And we're hopeful that many more patients will achieve more repigmentation with more use of the medicine.
So I also have psoriasis, and I use a medicine for that, another autoimmune disease. It treats the symptoms, which seems so different than what vitiligo is doing. Vitiligo seems like such an internalized symptom that manifests then with the lack of pigmentation on your skin. Psoriasis is different.
Yeah, psoriasis involves a different arm of the immune system that's active. And we have a lot of FDA-approved treatments for psoriasis to get it under better control, but no FDA-approved treatments for repigmenting for vitiligo.
And when you put the cream on, you just put it on the affected areas, or is it something you put on your whole body?
No, you just put it on the affected areas. And then the hope is by suppressing that part of the immune system that's too active, the body then naturally repigments. Sometimes getting a little sunlight in addition to using the cream can also help stimulate those pigment cells to repopulate those white areas.
But you only actually tested it on facial symptoms of vitiligo?
So it was tested on people's face and body.
Okay.
So far, the results that have been released are only for the face, but I'm optimistic that in the next few months, the results for how well it does repigmenting the body will also become public as well.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a potential new treatment for vitiligo. It's still a mystery what causes it, but it is an autoimmune disease. My guest is Dr. David Rosmarin. He's a dermatologist and vice chair for education and research in the Department of Dermatology at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, where they have come up with a topical cream that treats the symptoms of vitiligo. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It was a 2-year-long endeavor. How did you conduct the study? How did it work? How long did it last? And
great. So there were over 20 different sites that have been involved in the study across the country, and patients who have certain entry criteria, they had to have a certain amount of vitiligo, about a half a hand's worth on the face, and at least 3 hands worth on the body, were allowed to enter the study. And they used this cream at different doses or just a vehicle for 6 months. And then all patients who were given the vehicle were then allowed to use one of the 3 highest doses of the medicine. And then at the year mark, all patients got the highest dose of the medicine and were allowed to use light as well. The full study is still ongoing, but the 6-month results have been released, and the year results will be released within the next few months. That's how it was conducted.
You said you went with a cream approach to avoid the other kinds of side effects of the drug. Ruxolitinib. What are those negative health effects?
Sure. So if you take the medication orally and get systemic levels, you can be at higher risk for certain cancers. There's an infection risk, among some other side effects. But when you use it topically, the side effects that we're seeing, it may be a little bit of an application site reaction, maybe a little bit of redness, maybe a slight risk for mild acne, but it's very well tolerated, and we didn't see many adverse events, and certainly people didn't stop the medicine due to adverse events when it's used topically.
Did you treat some parts of some people's bodies and compare on what and how it changed? Was it only at the site of the treatment that the vitiligo was affected?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So we basically were looking at where the patients had the vitiligo, not on other areas that remained untreated.
Okay. All right. And as far as the dose goes, you said the highest dose. So there's different doses of this cream?
Yeah. So whenever a medicine's in development, we want to look at different doses of the medication because you always want the lowest effective dose to avoid side effects of a medication. And so if we can get the same efficacy by using a lower concentration of the medicine, then that would be better for further development. However, in this situation, the highest dose that was looked at, which is 1.5%, used twice a day, seems to do the best. And it also seems to be well tolerated, where we're not seeing a lot of side effects.
The topical cream has a ways to go before it gets FDA approval, right? What's the timeline look like for this?
Yeah. So for a medicine to be FDA approved, there have to be 2 phase 3 studies that confirm the results of the phase 2 study. This was the phase 2 program that was that's recently finishing up. And the phase 3 study is set to commence this winter and has been announced. And the company Incyte that makes this cream is in conversations with the FDA in order to design the trial appropriately, so it will hopefully lead to the first indication of a treatment for vitiligo.
You've said that the cream likely will be approved for treating eczema before vitiligo. Why is that?
Yeah, so it's also being looked at for patients who suffer from eczema or atopic dermatitis. And the study, the phase 3 program for eczema is ongoing right now and will likely conclude before we have results for the phase 3 program for vitiligo. So it's expected to be FDA approved for eczema before vitiligo.
Let's see. Jeff in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. David Rosmarin of Tufts Medical Center in Boston. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I'm sorry if the connection is not perfect. I just wanted to know, is differential diagnosis as concerned tinea versicolor? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Tinea versicolor. First of all, what's a differential diagnosis?
So whenever we see somebody with white spots, we always ask ourselves, is it vitiligo or could it be a different disease? And so there are multiple reasons we can see somebody that has hypopigmentation or whiter areas of skin. And one of those is tinea versicolor, which is due to a fungus called Malassezia. And it's very common, especially in the spring or summertime, on the upper chest and neck region. And that's luckily easily treated with antifungal medications. You can even use an antifungal or an anti-dandruff shampoo like Head and Shoulders or Celsin Blue to try to get rid of tinea versicolor.
What's it doing that creates the same sort of symptoms as vitiligo?
Yeah, so the fungus Malassezia actually has a protein in it that helps block the sun. Huh. That's one way. And also it can suppress the pigment cells. So one of the differences, though, between vitiligo and tinea versicolor is in vitiligo you see depigmentation. So there's no pigment at all.
Okay.
Tinea versicolor, it's hypopigmented. So it's just a little lighter in color.
Why doesn't typical sunscreens protect the unpigmented skin caused by vitiligo?
So sunscreens can protect the areas of vitiligo just like they can protect non-lesional skin.
Okay.
However, it's because you don't have the pigment to protect it, it's more easily can get burnt and become red. So that's why we often advise patients to use sunscreen. In addition, when in the summertime, if the pigmented areas are getting exposed to the sun, they're becoming darker, mm-hmm. Whereas the white depigmented areas stay the same, so you're enhancing the contrast, mm-hmm. so it can look worse. So oftentimes we'll advise patients to avoid the sun who have vitiligo to prevent that contrast and to prevent getting burned.
Dr. David Rosmarin, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me, Ann.
Dr. David Rosmarin is a dermatologist and vice chair for education and research in the Department of Dermatology at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, where they have developed a topical cream found to reverse the effects of vitiligo. You can just follow your news for more information about that as these studies are pursued. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Food and Drug Administration has approved three first-of-their-kind drugs in the past year designed to treat migraines and other debilitating headaches. All three drugs have been well-received, but they're not cheap. We're talking about how to treat and prevent migraines in 2019. Caroline Hoffman is the general manager and medical advisor for Cove. That's an online company that offers personalized migraine treatment. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for having me.
How do we define a migraine?
Yes, that's a very good question. So to put it very simply, a migraine is an extremely painful, often one-sided headache that can last from 4 to 72 hours. To put it a little less simply, the headache is only part of the one part of the migraine. A migraine typically also has accompanying symptoms like nausea and exhaustion coming with it. And last, what we hear from a lot of our patients is that migraines are truly debilitating. So it's more than just a headache. People are fully out of commission. They miss work. They just can't go about their day normally.
I describe it as like being hit by a truck.
That sounds pretty accurate.
So when you say one side of the head, for me, it's usually in the front. Is that what you mean?
Yes, it can actually happen left side, right side.
Okay.
What we hear very often is around the eyes.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different types of migraines. So it's but they're very often on one side of the head. And if you compare that, for example, to a headache from being dehydrated, that's everywhere. So that is quite different.
And what? You said there's lots of different migraines. That means there must be lots of different kinds of triggers.
There are so many triggers. You're absolutely right. What we see is there are some common triggers, and those include alcohol, stress, lack of sleep, lack of hydration, unhealthy foods. But triggers are very personal, and we really recommend people tracking their behavior. So in a migraine diary, for example, that they can actually identify trends and things that are happening around them when a migraine hits. We see changes in weather. I've read about people being triggered by citrus. So there are lots of different types of things that can trigger migraines.
Some people seem to get them all the time and others just occasionally.
Yes. So it really ranges. There are people who get one migraine a year, two migraines a year, to people who have 15 or more migraines a month. So there's really, really a broad range.
I think I had one in high school, I think. But then I didn't have another one until I was in my 40s.
Yes, that's very possible. And migraines is a tricky field, but that's very possible that, you get a migraine once and then you're okay for a while. But what we do see in the majority of patients is that they have migraines on a relatively frequent basis.
The FDA has approved three first-of-its-kind drugs specifically designed to prevent chronic migraines. Am I right about that, or is it to prevent
Yes.
or treat? Okay.
Yes, you're talking about the anti-CGRP drugs.
Mm-hmm.
They are typically self-injectable drugs, and they are Definitely not there to treat every single migraine patient, but for people who are not able to actually control their migraines with the other more established drugs that are on market and typically also a lot cheaper, the anti-CGRP medication seem to be working really well for the chronic migraine sufferers.
What, they're expensive, though.
They're very expensive.
Like how much?
A couple of $100 a month.
Oh, okay. Ouch. Why do they work? What is different about these?
So it's a new class of drugs. The question overall, the question is probably better answered by a neurologist, but the class of drugs has a different mechanism of action that blocks receptors and it's basically just a new mechanism of action that makes them work.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about migraines today. The FDA, as I said, has approved three first-of-its-kinds drugs specifically designed to prevent chronic migraines just in the past year. My guest is Caroline Hoffman. She's general manager and medical advisor for the online migraine platform Cove. If you have a question about migraines, this is your chance, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Don't wait. We've only got about 10 minutes left with Caroline Hoffman. In a Time article, one of those drugs was described as having made a night and day difference for one patient.
Yes, that's absolutely possible. And when you think about what these patients typically have gone through before actually getting to that drug, they have often tried a half dozen of different migraine medications. They have probably been on other preventative medications that have come with other side effects. So, yes, I mean, these drugs absolutely seem to work, and especially for those who can get them covered for insurance and who experience upwards of 8 migraines or so a month, that's definitely, it can be a good fit and definitely something to talk with our doctor about.
Why is nausea often associated with migraines? What do we know about that?
You know, we don't know that much about the nausea, but what we recommend is nausea is often a factor, nausea or even vomiting. And what we recommend people do is one, eating regularly can help prevent going into a full-blown migraine and basically having a relatively regular lifestyle. And then there are anti-nausea medications that can actually help those symptoms that accompany a migraine. So when we think about treating migraines, it's not just about treating the headache, but also treating the nausea that comes with it.
Mm. And then a lot of people have the visual manifestation of it as well. You said a lot of times they're centered around the eyes. And the one, I think one of the first times I got it as an adult, it was a oral. It looked like I was kind of seeing the northern lights in my office.
Absolutely. So that's what people call aura. And the aura often comes before a migraine. A lot of patients use it as a warning that a migraine is coming. And so it is a visual disturbance. Some people lose sight or have blurry vision or have flashing lights in their eyes, which is what you seem to be describing. It affects roughly 20% of migraine. And in many cases, it's a visual aura. It's a visual disturbance. And if you want to look at the silver lining of that, it is an early warning so you can start taking your acute medications to actually manage your migraine.
An email from Sarah says that she gets migraines with an aura. She asks, is it true that my risk of stroke is greater?
I'm not a doctor, so I can't comment on that, unfortunately. That's something I would encourage Sarah to discuss with her doctor.
Okay. And the FDA approval process for these drugs, obviously there's probably a big demand, even though they're very expensive. Chronic sufferers, the pain has got to be horrible.
Yes, absolutely.
How does the FDA go about approving things like that?
So So the FDA, there are two stages in terms of approvals. One is getting FDA approval, which is mostly about safety, and then safety and efficacy, and then you have also the pharma reimbursement processes, right? Because it wouldn't be helpful to just have it approved by the FDA, then we know it works and it's safe, but pharma companies, payers, insurance companies basically also need to then be willing to cover these drugs.
Are they?
Most companies do. It really depends. Insurance is such a complicated topic.
Mm-hmm.
You often have to, what's important to know is that these medications are very innovative. They are new. They're also very expensive. So insurance companies will typically ask that patients have tried other less expensive medications than before reimbursing the anti-CGRP drugs. So that's there is often a process involved that basically involves trial and error and before being able to get switched to the anti-CGRP medication.
Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments to make. First of all, about the medication situation. Now, I'm sure I had a migraine before when I was young in high school. I'm sure of that. And I'll get back to that in a second. It has to do with having an aura, which you haven't mentioned yet before.
Yeah, actually, we were talking about auras a little while ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, man. So I didn't tune in at the beginning. So the other thing is, now, I don't know if I do still have pretty strong headaches. They're not with any aura. They're not that half-sighted sort of feeling too much. But the only way that I can take care of these is if I stay up late and I know I'm up too late, I'll take an aspirin the night before to stave off any headache the next day. The other thing is I kind of massage around the corner of my eye, and that seems to help a lot too. Now, I don't know if these are sinus headaches anymore or just something else, but the headache's always on the same side around my temple. And if I don't do anything at all about it, it'll be more irritating.
Huh, okay. What kinds of, things like massage, Caroline Hoffman, do you ever see that been shown to be effective?
So anything that relieves stress, there's evidence that is effective. What we always say is it's not just about popping pills when a migraine hits. It's really about thinking about what triggers these migraines, and stress is often a factor. So meditation and yoga, even a couple of minutes a day, is proven to work. So I don't see a reason why massages couldn't work.
Okay. Let's see. James in Westerville, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hello. Well, go ahead.
Okay. I just want to make a comment. I found a cure for my own headaches. I think they were migraines. I'm using alternative treatments. One of them is called Deep Blue Essential Oil, which really works effectively.
Essential oils?
It cools the area. Also, I use some herbal treatments, ginseng and ginkgo biloba, which really works well.
All right. Have you, because of all the different triggers, Caroline Hoffman, it just depends.
It really depends. There are lots of there are supplements, for example, that have clinical evidence behind them working. Magnesium has very strong evidence that it's working. Vitamin B2, which is also called riboflavin, coenzyme Q10. There are some herbal remedies as well, essential oils, especially peppermint oil. Has been reported to work. So because migraines are so personal, often the remedies can also be quite personal.
James, thanks a lot. And Sarah in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I wanted to know the difference between migraines and cluster headaches. I had an acquaintance who suffered from cluster headaches, and they say that they're far worse than migraines. So,
Caroline Hoffman? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so the main distinction, and again, I'm not a doctor, but
sure,
the main distinction is that cluster headaches are indeed extremely painful, and they have this throbbing pain as well. There are some treatments that are specific to cluster headaches. To be honest, even pain and pain tolerance is very, very personal and specific. So I don't want to make a comparison on like, is cluster headache worse than migraines? They are different and they are treated differently. There are specific drugs for cluster headaches, and they don't necessarily, they don't last as long typically. They are often seasonal natures. There's like seasonal associations with cluster headache. So they're definitely a different type of headache.
Sarah, thanks for that question. As far as migraines go, does gender affect the experience or the occurrence of migraines?
Yes. We believe that 80% of women suffer from migraines and only 6% of men. So women are three times more likely to suffer from migraines. What's interesting is I think there's even a behavioral thing associated with it. Women also go a lot more to the doctor for migraines. So the perception is that it's even more skewed. On Co, for example, 90% of the customers or patients are women. Migraines also often run in families. So we see a lot of mother-daughter migraine sufferers, for example, and with respect to age, it's more common in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and typically less frequent post-menopause.
Yeah, so there's a hormonal possibly role in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Menstrual migraines are a big thing, so absolutely.
Okay, well, Caroline Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Anne.
Caroline Hoffman, she's general manager and medical advisor for the online migraine platform Cove. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Medical schools around the country are turning to the arts to help during the process of rehabilitation. That includes Ohio State in the Medicine and the Arts Roundtable. That's a group that uses the arts as a means of rehabilitation. Dr. Linda Stone is a retired family physician and founder of Humanism in Medicine and Medicine and the Arts at Ohio State University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Anna Soder is a professor emerita at Ohio State and an adjunct instructor at the Columbus College of Art and Design. She's a current chair of the Medicine and the Arts Roundtable under the leadership of Dr. Stone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The Medicine and the Arts Roundtable, we've talked about it before. This isn't a first time, but how does it work? Tell us.
Well, the Medicine and the Arts program itself was created to help us create a more humanistic environment in the medical school and the medical center for those who care for our patients and teach and do the research. So the one way we knew to do that magically was bringing the arts into the medical center in a greater quantity than we were doing before.
People might be out there thinking, are you talking about finger painting? What?
Actually,
which I actually would love to do someday.
This is true. We've done that. But with Medicine and the Arts, the people we bring into the medical center are from our great Columbus arts community. So Columbus Museum of Art, Opera Columbus, Ballet Matt Thurber, Columbus Children's Theater. Everybody rallied around us when we started this. And as that grew, we were bringing more performing arts into the medical center. People approached us and said, well, what about the people in the medical center who work with the arts for patients and families? What if they're focused on bringing the arts as a healing presence to patients and families? And so we connected with Ann Harding, who is the art therapist at the James, and others, and decided that was a separate group. That group needed to really focus on what was happening in our medical center and in the community that served patients and families, help them through a healing process, whether it was cancer or brain injury or whatever they were going through. So that's where the roundtable founded. Now, Anna now chairs that, and so she can give us even a nicer picture of the round table itself.
So the round table is for faculty and staff, or patients as well, or everybody?
It's really everybody, but it's focused on the sustaining of the spirit of those who work with patients.
Okay.
So it's frontline, and frontline in that sense that the staff who work with patients, of course, are also needing to be supported emotionally and spiritually and creatively. So the use of the creative activities, particularly the creative activities like art therapy, which is what Anne Harding had done and has been doing, continues to do with cancer patients at the James, has been expanded to include music therapy, as well as, for example, the Hospital Poets, which I founded in 2011. Wild idea that I took to Linda, who listened.
Hospital poets,
yeah. And I can talk a little bit more about that in a moment, if you like. And there's also physical therapy, dance therapy, music therapy. At our meetings, what we do is we actually do the sorts of activities that they staff and nurses and practitioners take back to the patients and their families, so that we too learn about how this actually affects us emotionally, psychologically, and have an awful lot of fun in the process. So our meetings are anything but dry.
Yeah, so that's an interesting aspect of it. So it's about helping the frontline providers. Mm-hmm. In improving their way of life and everything, but it's also helping them better understand how art therapy, music therapy, and everything plays into rehabilitation for their patients.
Absolutely. It has that dual focus and dual purpose, because you really can't, I think, understand just how deeply it goes and what it actually does unless you've done it yourself.
Can you give me an example, Dr. Stone, of just an anecdotal example of how it's had an impact?
I think we have examples every day, but one that really sticks with me right now is we have in the College of Medicine a whole student section for humanism and medicine, and it too has started to focus a lot on the arts. So the students started an orchestra, and it's now not just the College of Medicine, it's all the health sciences are invited, and in fact law and engineering are in the orchestra. So we have this professional school orchestra. So on Tuesday evening, I can walk into that hall and I'll watch the students come in from all their various parts of the campus with their instrument cases. And they set them down and they take out their instrument and the transformation begins on their faces. Then they walk down and they start to rehearse because they do two concerts a year. They start to rehearse, and by the time they leave, these are people who have taken the stress on their shoulders for all the training they're doing to serve people in the future and left it behind for just an hour and a half, and let the music take over.
And you see.
Oh, you see it.
You can see and
you
observe
can.
The changes in them. You know, I was just at a wake recently for a musician. Well, he was a writer, musician, publisher, but his love of music was obvious. And someone said that just days before he passed away from pancreatic cancer, he had people over and was able to play for hours and was exhausting everybody around him. Is there evidence of all of this, that it's not just something you observe anecdotally, but that's been studied?
Yes, and actually we have started into a whole research on this, which we can talk about another time, but the evidence is overwhelming at how the arts can impact the person that's giving the care as well as the patient that's receiving the care. We have some wonderful things done by Tracy McCambridge at the Wexner Center for the Arts, in which she brings patients and families in with traumatic brain injury.
I've talked about that before in the program.
It's this great art experience. But the research is growing out there, we certainly can provide anyone with that kind of background.
Yeah.
But so many colleges of medicine are finding the answers to training young professionals really lies in not only the science we have to accomplish, but in the arts. We have to keep that human being alive, and that's what the arts helps us do.
Yeah.
Can I read a poem that was written by a medical student? I also am submissions editor for the Ether Arts, which is the journal that's actually produced by the med students when they come in their first year.
It's called Ether Arts?
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a copy of it. I actually bought a couple of copies. And maybe I've got extras of these. Okay. I can let you have that one. but this is a really astounding collection of work. And every year a new group of students come in and then they do this work, and I work with them, and we choose pieces, both poetry, visual, photographs, photograph drawings, as well as prose. And it's I hope I can read it without kind of getting all teary. It's called Night Watch. Jessica Rutsky is a fourth. Now she's graduated and she's out. It's unsettling, running against your body's clock, winding back hands that tick in the deepest confines of your spine, so that you rise with the foolhardy moon, set with the unrelenting sun. Death never sleeps, and why should you? Not when there are fears to conquer, hearts to beat against a cold stethoscope, bright lights to shine in young eyes when the dark of night has sapped every parent of reason and patience. You are the first line, the brave and ever-changing chosen, who answer the calls of the stories that will come to fruition only for the night watch. See how they tread with tired smiles, weary legs, steady hearts.
What's the title of that?
The title is Night Watch.
Night Watch.
Yes.
And Jessica not only graduated from medical school, she is a resident at Nationwide Children's Hospital. So she's here with us, and she still keeps writing for the Ether Arts magazine and inspiring medical students. She's a really mentor to many, especially when it comes to the arts and writing.
So many people assume that people in the medical field, because it's so demanding academically, that they don't have outside they're not able to develop those outside interests. They're too busy getting straight A's so they can get into medical school. Yeah.
You are absolutely correct. In fact, when our medical students come in, the new ones will be here early August, the first thing we say to them is, you think you've come here to climb this mountain of information, but you can't leave who you are behind. And so the humanism medicine program, including the orchestra and the choir and all the different things we do, are here to remind you that it is fine to play the piano or write a poem or sing in the choir. We aren't asking you to give up who you are just because you came to medical school. And that's true with all seven of our health science students. They do come in with that attitude. And we have to
They have to give everything else
up. They have to give it up. And we'd say, no, please don't give it up. Your patients are waiting for you as a human being on the other side of this training.
And being able to cope with being a human being, because the emotions are enormous. And I think, you know, it's probably a truism from the former outsiders, patient end, that, you know, doctors in staff, nursing staff, so on, can appear to be cold and aloof, but actually they're not. They're extraordinarily vulnerable. And this kind of work, you know, with the arts, the expressing of what it is to be on night watch, for example, enables them to basically take the lid off a lot of that internal emotional pressure and keep in touch with their human selves, which then enables them to be compassionate with their patients and each other.
Are most of the people involved in the Medicine and the Arts Roundtable young? I mean, do you invite I'm just wondering, because they're being brought up and raised in a different era of medicine than people were 40 or 50 years ago. The whole bedside manner thing has become a huge issue. Dr. Stone?
The roundtable, as well as the Medicine and the Arts Board, we have all ages, all backgrounds, and that enriches the conversation. So that when we move forward, we're trying not to miss anyone. We take 200 students a year in the College of Medicine. What do we do to reach out to them? And this has been part of it. Fortunately, about 3 years ago, Dr. Kent, our new dean, came on board. And as you may know, he has really stepped into helping us move forward. We just had our 10th anniversary for Medicine in the Arts, and he has declared this a program within the College of Medicine that receives his personal support. So because of that, we're now trying to move up several levels in how do we even do more things that reach every individual. We don't want to miss anyone, whether it's faculty, staff, students, or residents.
So that in what you're saying is how do we pursue different artistic ventures, mm-hmm. poetry, music, mm-hmm. Finger painting?
Yes.
Right. Well, the hospital poets is interesting because the students are involved in that as well. And basically, you know, we've got these three somewhat elderly individuals, i.e. me, Fred Anderley, and Charlene Fix, you know.
Former host of here at WSU, right?
Right. And Fred and Charlene co-convene hospital poets with me. I founded back in 2011 on my own, but I'm thrilled that they're part of the team because they're both wonderful poets, and at the same time they also get the thing, and so there are three of us there, and then these young things who come in, starry-eyed, etc. Age is irrelevant.
Dana, and you're not necessarily looking for people who are of experience in poetry. They
exactly.
may have no experience at all. It's just exposing them to the arts and finding what makes them tick.
That's exactly right. Poetry, because actually this program never was about the poet. It was about poetry. And that's a rule that we have. Anyone who comes on to do readings, one-third is their own, two-thirds is poetry from other sources.
Okay.
So no self-promoting here. But this is because, as I put it in an article, poetry is capable of enfolding in one and the same breath the light and the dark, the odd and the familiar, putting flesh back on the skeleton, a reminder of the richness we're losing, a feast of thought, experience, emotion, and intellect. That's what poetry is. And if you focus on the poet, you lose mm-hmm. all that.
I took a poetry writing class at Michigan State, and I remember I wrote about it. It was about a tree brushing on a window against my room, and I wrote about it, and everybody thought it was about sex. So I was like, really? No. But that's what you reminded me of when you said that. It's just it's not about me. It's mm-hmm. about whatever people find in it.
Exactly.
And why is that important to the frontline people who provide our healthcare?
Because a lot of the kind of human experience that's being experienced in hospitals is so huge that regular, ordinary language really can't cope with it, can't describe it, can't measure it. So what you really need is a language that's very figurative. I'm not going to get into definitions or anything like that, but, you know, the old metaphor simile thing that's there in very large doses. And that enables you to represent, not just represent, but to represent what an experience is through this very much larger, going towards a symbolic picture.
And keeping in mind, too, that when you look at the health professions, we have a larger challenge as far as depression, suicide, so many things that Dr. Steve Cavey has informed us about and done research on. It helps us to understand this is serious business. And we love the arts. We love bringing in the medical center, but mm-hmm. we have a very serious purpose.
Yeah, this goes beyond decoration.
mm-hmm. Gotcha. And then what about, does this apply as well to nurses and other frontline people? We're just about out of time, but I want to make
yes.
sure that it's not just for physicians.
It's no. all seven okay. of the health sciences.
Everybody.
And
okay.
they all sit, have a representative on the Medicine and the Arts Board. So every one of the health sciences, all seven of them.
And admin staff,
yes.
janitors, the whole thing.
Oh,
okay.
Right.
All right. Because they're seeing people in pain, people
yes.
struggling, people rehabilitating too, and they're at the front lines as well. And they do the night shifts as well, right?
That's right.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Linda Stone, retired family physician, founder of Humanism in Medicine and Medicine and the Arts at Ohio State. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
And Anna Soder, Professor Emerita at Ohio State and adjunct instructor at the Columbus College of Art and Design. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.